states, not all. And one of the things we want to look at is the geography of the death penalty today. Why is it that certain parts of the country have historically had it and used it in large quantities? I should say, for the sake of those who are perhaps listening to this tape in future centuries or whenever, who I am. My name is Charles Lutz. I direct the Office of Church and Society for the American Lutheran Church. And we're looking at this issue because our office has been working with the question of capital punishment over the last few years. How many of you come from states that have the death penalty on the books? The rest of you come from states that don't, or don't you know?
Don't know.
Okay. Well, at least you can find out today, because the sheet I gave you summarizes what is presented in four categories. States that have had executions in the last 10 years. The last 10 years is significant because it was beginning with about January 1977 that we reinstituted the taking of life for certain crimes in certain states. What happened was the Supreme Court in 1972, with one stroke, declared all of the existing death penalty statutes unconstitutional because of the way they were functioning or were written. They were not acceptable to the court at that time in terms of fair and equitable treatment of people without regard to race or sex or economic class. That is, the states that had the death penalty and were using it at that time did not have their statutes written in an acceptable way for the court, and it was basically on the argument that they didn't fall equitably on all classes of people if they were convicted. Your chances of being executed were greater if you were non-white, were greater if you were male, and were greater if you were poor. The irony is that many observers over the last decade believe that that's still the case. It's still happening that way. But in any case, in 72, the Supreme Court wiped out all of the death penalty statutes. From about 1968 onward, we had not been executing anybody. There had been a period, we reached a peak in the 30s when several hundred a year were being executed. Then it declined gradually until the late 60s when we stopped, even in states that had it, we stopped taking life for crimes. And then the Supreme Court in 72 declared no more executions under the existing statutes. In 76, the court ruled, in a second ruling that was very important, that the penalty of death is not by in and of itself unconstitutional. It depends on how it is written, and said that states could rewrite death penalty statutes if they chose, and many have. So the situation today is that there are, in the first category on this sheet, there are, 12 states that have had executions between January 77 and this April, about a 10-year period. The first one after those two Supreme Court actions came in January of 77. That's why the dating is from that time. So for about 10 years, we have had death penalty statutes back on the books in certain states and actual executions taking place. However, you will see that the number of executions has been relatively small in those years in comparison to the number on death row. The number on death row as of May 1 this year is 1,714. Those are all people sentenced to death who are still alive, sitting on death row. Waiting for what? Well, waiting for the appeals process to run its course. Waiting for, I don't know what all the legal issues are, but some have been convicted by juries from which people who are opposed to the death penalty in principle have been excluded. That issue was just decided by the Supreme Court a week or two ago. Anybody know what the court decided? The court ruled that people who've been convicted by juries that had opponents of the death penalty excluded from those juries, that is, challenged by prosecutors and excluded, that they are legally convicted and can therefore be executed. So that was one of the issues that was pending. And the Supreme Court just decided in a very controversial decision that you have no constitutional right to have on a jury, if you're being tried for a capital crime, you have no constitutional right to have on your jury of peers somebody who thinks the death penalty is a mistake. In other words, you can have all 12 on a jury who believe in the death penalty. Okay? That was one issue that kept some people on death row. I think those 1,700 on death row, unless something very unforeseen happens very soon, are all going to be executed within the next year or two. That means we're going to have something of a bloodbath on or out of death row in our states, and in certain states more than others, because you can see how concentrated the people on death row are. Of the 1,700 and some, about half are in six states. Those six states are Florida, Texas, Georgia, California, Illinois, and Pennsylvania. So the death row population is not distributed evenly, even within states that have the death penalty. And that's another interesting study in itself that we may want to talk about a little bit. Why is that? Second category here, are there any of these sheets left? I think if couples would take only one, they'd probably get around. And there are some new people who've joined us over here who may want to look at it. The second category is states that have had no executions in the last decade. That is, since the Supreme Court said states can reinstitute the death penalty. There are 21 states that have had no executions, but who have quite a population of people sentenced to death. California leads the list with 177. That's a lot of people waiting on death row for what may eventually be the ultimate penalty. And it goes down all the way to Oregon, which reinstituted the death penalty just, I think, within the last year. Anybody here from Oregon? It was recently, wasn't it? Recently reinstituted in Oregon through, I think, a referendum of the people, and then that said to the legislature, we support your reinstituting it. The legislature did, and you now have one person on death row. Thirdly, there are four states that have death penalty statutes but have not sentenced anybody to death since the reincarnation of death penalty in 1976. Those are New Hampshire, Vermont, Connecticut, and South Dakota. And then there are 14 states, actually 13 states and one jurisdiction, the District of Columbia, that do not have the death penalty on their books, therefore could not at this point sentence anybody to death. And as far as I can tell, there's no real movement in any of those 14 jurisdictions to restore it, with the possible exception of Michigan. There's been some talk of it in Michigan recently. It's one way people feel the society can get tough when there's a high crime rate, and that may be the reason in Michigan, but I don't know that it's going anywhere in terms of serious reinstitution of the death penalty. I mentioned Michigan because that was the first state in the Union to abolish the death penalty. Michigan repealed the death penalty in 1846 before anybody else had done so. Minnesota repealed it in 1907, relatively early also, and then these other states had either done so by the time of the Supreme Court decision in 1972 or had their existing statutes. This was the case with Iowa. When I was growing up in Iowa in the 30s and 40s and 50s, Iowa occasionally would hang somebody in Fort Madison, which is where the state penitentiary is. Since 1972, Iowa has not reinstituted the death penalty. So you can see the list. Now, another thing about the geography of the death penalty is, well, I'll ask you, what strikes you as you look at the map, if you can read it, if you can see those faint lines, or if you can't read the map lines, just looking at the list of states without the death penalty and states that have it but haven't been using it, those 18, what strikes you geographically?
Lutherans don't believe in the death penalty.
Pardon? The South what? The South has it, the Southeast in particular, and not only has it, but uses it in large quantity.
The central states are the ones that are free of it.
And where else?
East.
Northeast.
Northeast. New England and New York and the North Central states. And then you've got West Virginia and the District of Columbia, Alaska and Hawaii. I have heard some Lutherans say, well, it's areas where Lutherans are strong, and I suppose they're, if they're opposed to the death penalty, they'd like to claim credit for Lutheran strength. I think that would be an invalid conclusion, because as we'll see in a minute, Lutherans in at least one body seem to support the death penalty about as strongly as the population as a whole. One thing that is interesting is that in states that don't have it and haven't had it for a long time, support for the death penalty is relatively low. In states that have it, there's strong and higher support for the death penalty. And I suppose that's what we would expect, because people tend to get used to the status quo. Let me back up now and say some things in a more general way about history, including biblical history, on capital punishment. One other introductory comment before I do that. Support for the death penalty seems to ebb and flow. It seems to go up and down. And I think one reason for that is it's a kind of barometer policy question for many people, a way of testing the general political climate. In a climate that is, for lack of a better term, liberal or socially progressive, when that's the trend in the country, support for the death penalty goes down. When left of center politics seem to be in the saddle, support for the death penalty goes down. So through the 50s and 60s, that seemed to be the trend. And there was a strong and obvious decline in support for the death penalty in the polls, and I think the courts reflected that too, through about 1972, somewhere in there. When the pendulum swings back toward the right, support for the death penalty seems to go up. And I think we're in a climate politically now when we're swinging back toward the right, or have swung back toward the right. For whatever reasons, it's one of the most dramatic shifts in opinion that you can measure. The polls indicate that back in the late 60s, early 70s, support for the death penalty nationwide was never got above about 25%. Recent polls, Gallup and so on, indicate that it's up around 80%. If you just ask people on the street, are you for or against capital punishment? That's what you get today. Now that's a dramatic shift in a rather short time. In 15 years, we have almost switched the percentages. And I don't know what all's going on there. But it seems to me that one reason may be that the death penalty is a powerful symbol, even if it's not used. People like to have it on the books and have it available as a way of signaling to those people, the criminals, that we're going to get tough. I think it's a powerful symbol for people, therefore, even if it's not utilized much.
I think one reason California has swung, though, is because we've had so many mass murders.
Yeah, okay, that's a phenomenon of the last, especially of the last decade or so, yeah.
And they're on the loose, you know.
Yeah.
You don't know if your daughter's going to be the next person who's raped and murdered or not.
And to indicate again how emotional the issue is and how much of a barometer issue it is, right now in California you have a recall petition going on regarding a state Supreme Court justice, right? How many of you are from California or know about that? Okay. The issue, at least in part, the issue is she's soft on the death penalty. She won't use it. She won't allow it to be used when she has a chance to stop it. So it does become a kind of litmus test issue for many people in terms of the general political climate. Where do you stand on the death penalty?
Can I say something?
Yeah.
These people who come out and get on the massacring are not Californians. They come from other states.
They're from out of state. Okay.
The one that did this just north of the Mexico border came from one of your Midwest states, and most of them aren't native. They come out there and commit their crimes for some reason. So it isn't just the people of California who are there.
California has a way of collecting kooks from all around the country. I think that's true over the years. It's part of California's curse or blessing, whatever. But California does tend to attract unusual people. Another interesting thing for the church is that on this issue, more than most issues of a social and political nature, there is a wide gap between clergy and laity. Support for the death penalty among the clergy is very low, has continued to be very low for all of these years, all of this period we're talking about. All of the studies that ask that kind of question of both groups and then separate the answers show that today there's a very wide gap on support for the death penalty. Among clergy, it's 20% or less. Among laity, it tends to be up where the general public is, around 80%, four. Well, that's a big gap. When you get a 60% gap on any question in the same church between the ordained and the non-ordained, that's at least interesting, whatever it says. And I don't know that it's necessarily a problem or a bad thing, but it's a reality, and we ought to be aware of it. Among college students, there's been a study over many years of entering freshmen. A couple hundred thousand across the country every year are polled on a variety of issues, and they ask the same kinds of questions year after year, so then you can make comparisons. In 1971, 58% of all entering freshmen favored abolition of the death penalty. Now remember, that was the time when I said we had practically eliminated it because it was still on the books, but nobody was executing people anymore in the late 60s, early 70s. In 72, a year later, the Supreme Court threw out all the existing statutes. By 1984, 13 years later, 58% in 1971 favored abolition of the death penalty. In 1984, just 13 years later, it was down to 26% of entering freshmen. Again, mirroring the society as a whole, I think. So what's going on here? Those are dramatic shifts in a rather short time. Quickly, in history, capital punishment was once used for all sorts of crimes, from adultery to pickpocketing. The biblical record you're somewhat familiar with. In the Old Testament, there was a whole list of crimes for which you could be given the death penalty. Let me just read you a few of them. That's all summarized, incidentally, in this study. In the Old Testament, death was prescribed for many offenses we would consider vastly disproportionate today. Striking or cursing one's father or mother. The rebellion of teenagers. A woman unchaste at her wedding. Adultery, which also was applied basically to women only. The oppression of strangers, widows, or orphans. That's interesting. You could get the death penalty for not welcoming the Central American refugee in your midst, okay? A little bit of license there, but not a whole lot. How could you appeal to the Old Testament code as a support for using the death penalty on murder while rejecting that same code when it prescribes the same penalty for adulterers, rebellious teenagers, and so on? I think that's one of the issues of biblical interpretation, because many people who appeal to the Old Testament in support of death penalty, and it's certainly there, would not apply it as the Old Testament does to the whole list of offenses, but only to the usually the crime of homicide. Incidentally, today about the only crime for which the death penalty is used is homicide, and certain categories of homicide. Almost never for rape anymore, unless a death occurs in the course of it. Almost never for treason. The last death penalty use for treason, some of you in this room are old enough to remember that, I think. It has to be under our federal code during wartime or a state of national emergency or the aftermath thereof, and it's for only one crime, treason. Does anybody remember the last who died because of treason in this country? The Rosenbergs, who were accused of giving atomic secrets to the Soviets. But that was in the 40s, and I don't think it's happened since. What about the other parts of the world? It's virtually gone in modern democratic societies. It's gone in Israel, in Scandinavia, in Western Europe generally, in Canada, in Mexico. One of the first acts of the Sandinistas in Nicaragua when they came to power in 1979 was to abolish the death penalty, and it has not been reestablished. It remains today chiefly where? Where in your perception is the death penalty?
Iran,
yeah. In some other Muslim-dominated countries. Where?
Right here at home.
In the U.S., yes.
South Africa
uses it, and the USSR. But most of Eastern Europe doesn't use it, the other Soviet satellite countries.
Does China use it?
People's Republic?
Yeah.
They have it on the books, and very occasionally in recent years they have used it, but not much, nothing like on the order of our country or South Africa or the Soviet Union. Who is executed? Well, today, as it was when the Supreme Court made its judgment in 72, it is still primarily males who are economically marginal and who kill white people in the southeastern U.S. That's what it basically comes down to in terms of statistics. There are exceptions to that. But the figures are disproportionate to the crimes committed. Women commit 30% of the murders currently in the United States. 30% of the homicides, almost entirely for women, it's within domestic settings, within the family. They can't take it anymore and they kill their husband. Or for whatever reason, it's usually a family member. Women are very seldom found guilty of going out to do armed robbery for drugs or whatever reason. But 3/10 of the murders are committed by women. What percentage of the executions in this century do you guess has been among women? You think it's 3/10? No, it's much lower. It's 1%. There was one celebrated case in North Carolina rather recently. It was in the heat of an election campaign for the, I think it was the Senate. Yeah, it was Jesse Helms' seat in the Senate. The governor, who was running against him, had to make a decision whether to allow an execution of a woman to occur. He finally said yes to it, and whether he wished it or not, it inevitably got tied up with that election race because people were watching on both sides to see would he allow this execution to happen? Well, he did. That was a woman who had poisoned a number of people in the same family. You may recall the incident. She also apparently had become an evangelical Christian while she was in prison. And the people who said she shouldn't be executed were pointing to that, said, look, her life has changed. She's a different person now. She should not be executed. But she was. But the execution of women is rather rare. More than 54% of the executions since 1930 have been minority group members. There's still a very strong feeling among many, and I'm one of them, that racism and classism, economic classism, play a major role in who gets the chair and who does not. That's partly a function of what kind of legal help you can afford. Many of the poor, white and non-white, cannot afford the best legal help. And of course, a disproportionate number of the poor are persons of color. The U.S. pattern we've already reviewed, it was sort of on its own, winding down to virtually nothing in the late 60s. The Supreme Court in 72 said the existing statutes are unconstitutional. In 76, the court said you can rewrite death penalty statutes if you wish, and about 3/4 of the states have, but not all of them are utilizing it to the extent that certain ones, like Florida and Texas, and a few other states of the old Southeast, the old Confederacy, are. Well, let me just summarize quickly the arguments for and against. You've heard all of these, I'm sure, many times. The arguments for include we have to get tough. We have to show the whole society, we have to tell ourselves, certainly we have to tell would-be criminals, that we're not going to abide lightly the increase in crimes of violence. And people who say it deters crime really believe that. It's hard to prove either way, I think. You really have a hard time. Though people who don't accept that argument think that they can prove that it doesn't make any difference. People who are for the death penalty and don't accept the deterrence argument say, well, at least it'll stop this person from doing it again. And I think that's indisputable. If you take that life, that person is not again going to take another life. The arguments against are that it doesn't deter crime, that it's irreversible. If you make a mistake, you can't correct it, and that it doesn't end violence. And you don't stop violence with more violence. On that point, I'd like to read a little excerpt from a group of law enforcement people in the state of Florida, where much of the focus of the debate has moved because Florida has such a large number on death row and has been executing more than anybody else in the last decade, and has had a governor in recent years who says that he believes in the death penalty, and he has never agreed to pardon somebody who was headed for execution. This comes from a 1984 statement of the criminal justice program at the University of Florida. On numerous occasions, Florida's Governor Graham has stated that his fundamental rationale for capital punishment is to reduce the state's homicide rate. As criminologists at the state's leading university, we feel a professional and ethical obligation to report that there is no credible scientific research that supports the contention that the threat or the use of the death penalty is or has been a deterrent to homicide. That's what all the students of the issue say. There's no credible research to support it. That doesn't mean people in their gut don't feel it anyway, that it will deter. The quote continues, "Other justifications of capital punishment are possible. However, whether or not the death penalty reduces the homicide rate is an empirical question which cannot be answered on moral or political grounds. The question has been clearly answered by numerous research projects conducted over the last 50 years. This deterrence research does not provide a legitimate basis for our state's death penalty policy." This statement is endorsed by the entire faculty of criminologists at the University of Florida. But the interesting thing about such statements is they don't change anybody's mind, or almost never do. People have their minds made up about the death penalty being a good thing. They tend to stay there. And no amount of evidence from studies like this will change their mind. Now, there are some who've tried to reach something of a compromise between using the death penalty just in general for capital crimes, murder in the first degree, premeditated, whatever the statute says, and those who want no use of it at all. And they tend to support the death penalty for very rare occasions and very rare situations. For example, people who commit a second murder while they're in prison, having already been convicted of a murder. There isn't much more you can do to somebody who's serving a life sentence for committing a second murder, unless you use the death penalty as an additional penalty for that kind of crime. Others say the use of the death penalty should be reserved for the killing of a police officer, a law enforcement officer in the line of duty. Some say it should be used only for the crime of treason in wartime. And so you get some who really oppose the death penalty for general usage, but will allow for it under certain special circumstances like that. Now, finally, let me share with you the results of the study in one church body that's fairly recent on this issue. The American Lutheran Church was asked in 1983, I think it was, by a couple of our districts and one of our national boards, the Board for Service and Mission in America, to take a new look at the death penalty question. The ALC had never taken a position on it, one of the few major church bodies in the U.S. that has not. Most of the church bodies in the U.S. that have taken a position against. The U.S. Catholic Conference, Catholic bishops, major Protestant bodies, the LCA, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, I think, has a position supporting the death penalty as something that the state may do in certain circumstances. But most of the church bodies have taken a position, and it's been a position against. Well, the ALC has never done that. The ALC, in a 1972 statement, about the time the Supreme Court was wrestling with it, came out with an analysis of the issue that said, here are the arguments for, here are the arguments against. Individual believers need to make up their mind where they stand and through the political process make their will known. So the church body did not take a position. So in 1983, it was asked to take a new look at that. And in fact, the request came from bodies that felt we should come out against the death penalty. That's what they indicated. So we commissioned a draft document, which is what you have in your hands. We submitted to all the congregations and invited them to study it and respond. That never draws a very high percentage of response. It's, I think, distressingly low, but at least congregations have an opportunity to look at it and report their feelings back to the process. We got about a 7% response. That is, about 350 of the 5,000 congregations in the ALC looked at it, at least looked at it in a way that led to a group report coming back to us in Minneapolis. I think others dealt with it and didn't bother to send in a written report. We asked them not only to study the issue in this four-session process that's outlined there, but to tell us whether they thought their church body should take a position against the death penalty, or for the death penalty, or to reaffirm the 1972 position, which is not to take a position as a church body, to let individual believers decide for themselves, which they will do anyway, incidentally, even if the church body has a position. At least in Lutheran practice, that doesn't bind the conscience of members. And I'm happy about that. And in fact, there is. Now, these came back about mid-84, I think, was the closing date for the response. That's the time frame. So almost 2 years ago now, this was going on. The ALC should oppose the death penalty. From congregational groups in death penalty states, only 14% voted for that. In non-death penalty states, 31%. A little over two times as great, but still not a majority, but a plurality. In non-death penalty states said the ALC should come out against the death penalty. The total for that position then was about 22%. Of all responding groups. The ALC could support the death penalty. In death penalty states, that was almost 37%. In non-death penalty states, about 23.5%. And the total, 31%. So by a slight plurality, the total result was that we should support the death penalty, but it was less than one-third of all the groups, and certainly well less than half. The ALC should reaffirm its 72 position, which is not to take a position as a church body. 33.5% in the death penalty state said that's what we should do. 22% in the non-death penalty state said, yeah, do that. Overall, almost 29% opted for that. A little less than support the death penalty, but very close, 31-29. And then other. In the death penalty states, 15.5% had some other, and I'll tell you what other included in a minute. 23% in the non-death penalty states, and overall about 19% came up with some other conclusion. Well, other meant either one of two things for the most part. Either the group itself was split, there was no majority position within the group, so they couldn't take they couldn't produce a result. Or, and this was more common, they said, however we feel about the death penalty, we think the larger issue is the criminal justice system itself. And we wish you'd address that and develop a policy statement on the criminal justice system, because people who favored the death penalty favored it because they didn't trust the criminal justice system to be tough. It was letting too many people slip through the holes, through the cracks. And people who opposed the death penalty opposed it because they didn't trust the criminal justice system to operate fairly. So for either reason, those favoring and those opposing the death penalty, the real villain in the piece, they said, is the criminal justice system itself, the way it's working. We don't have confidence in it. We don't trust it. We don't think it's good for the society as a whole. We don't think it's good for victims. And we don't think it's good for perpetrators of crime. It's just not functioning. We don't have confidence in it. Okay. So I'll wrap this up by telling you what we did as a result of this. I don't know what you would do, but when that kind of data comes back from a constituency in a church body, you have to take that seriously if you're going to honor the process. And the Standing Committee for Church and Society, which I work for, said there is no way on the basis of this result that we can recommend to the General Convention an anti-death penalty position or a pro-death penalty position. We're simply too divided. There is no consensus in this church. So what we did was what the other responding group said, we commissioned a study on the criminal justice system. And that is now out. It's just off the press, and it's being shared with our congregations this summer. That means we're not going to bring to convention any kind of position on the death penalty itself. What does that mean for the new church? Well, it means the LCA will come into the new church with an anti-death penalty position dating from 1968. The ALC will come in with no position, and the AELC, as far as I know, has no position on the death penalty. What will be the position of the new church? It will not have a position until it takes one. It will have a history. It can say, well, part of our predecessor, one of our predecessor bodies took this position, the other two did not have a position. That will be true on some other issues too, incidentally, and so the new church will just have to, in its life as it unfolds, decide where it wants to be on certain large policy questions of that kind. But this is one on which there's a distinct difference between the two large bodies entering that merger. Okay, I think probably I should stop there and invite general discussion of this whole subject, and I hope there are in the group people on both sides of the issue or who have feelings tilting either way, because that will make for the best discussion.
How much of an effect has execution by lethal injection had on the discussion? So I wonder, do you regard that as, you said you're opposed to it.
Yeah.
Death penalty. Do you regard that as a violent means of execution?
Well, I think any means of execution is violent. I mean, I guess it's how we use the word violent. It seems to me that the taking of a life is always a violent act. The deliberate taking of a life by the state or by anybody else is always an act of violence. It may be justified violence.
Like euthanasia, that's a violent act
too? I think if you end a life, that's an act of violence, however you do it. Yeah. If you pull the plug, I think if you pull the plug on somebody who's dying of cancer, there may be justification for doing that, but it's still an act of violence. That is, there is human involvement in the ending of a life. Now, our tradition has always said that that kind of violence known as war is justifiable under certain circumstances. Most Lutherans, probably most people in this room, are not pacifists. I think the only one who always avoids in principle, the use of violence is a principled pacifist. All the rest of us will make exceptions that allow for violence. And I think the death penalty is an example of that. I think an abortion is an act of violence. It may be justified in certain circumstances. For me, it is. But it's still an act of violence. So I think the Lutheran ethic, and probably the mainstream Christian ethic in this area, has always said there is a legitimate place for violence under certain conditions, under certain circumstances. Because not to do violence would be to allow a greater evil to occur or obtain. So it's a kind of lesser evil ethic, I think, that we have when it comes to violence. It's not the only ones I know who draw the line against any kind of violence and consistently hold to it in the Christian tradition are the so-called peace churches. The Quakers, the Mennonites, the Church of the Brethren, they tend to be, not all of their people will be, but their official church positions are quite consistent at that point in saying that no act of violence will be permissible, that the alternative is always preferable ethically. But that has not been historically a Lutheran position. Lutherans Lutherans down to the present day have tended to support the state's right to take life, and I guess I would too. I don't think I would support the state's need to take life in our society in the present time, because I don't think it's a good public policy. It doesn't achieve what the supporters say it will achieve. But
well, granted that this lethal injection thing then is still violent, you think it has affected the discussion anyway?
How do people in the group feel about that? Why don't you say a little more about what lethal injection involves? And
you know, I may propose death penalty by electrocution or cyanide.
Or firing squad, they still use that in some states, hanging.
But lethal injection seems more civilized. Mm-hmm. I mean, the one who dies doesn't go through the throes of, you know, like they say people in gas chambers, you know, they ride around.
Yeah.
Or being hanged. I mean, this is so barbaric. Lethal injection. He's going to go to sleep.
It's humane.
It's humane.
But the result is the same.
Yeah.
Just because it's not graphic, that, you know, like hanging.
Yeah.
I've heard, and I just read something in news magazines, you know, that people are happy that the lethal injection has come upon the scene because it makes it more legitimate.
Yeah, more acceptable.
More acceptable.
Yeah. I think that's true for some people. I do not think that makes any difference for people who are in principle opposed to the death penalty. I don't think it changes their minds, but over here. Out of proportion to their numbers. Yeah.
And maybe this could take one on death row. Granted, they probably don't.
Yeah, you're right. The violent crime committed by racial groups in our society is not in direct proportion to their numbers in our society. That is true. First of all, let me give you the numbers for the people on death row by racial group. I meant to do that. Of the 1,714 or whatever it is who are currently on death row as of May this year, there have been a couple more executions and undoubtedly some more have been sentenced, but that's roughly where we are, about 1,700. 51% of those are white. Those are the people on death row, and we can assume that at least most of them are going to be executed eventually, unless some new court judgment comes along. 42% of them are black. Blacks constitute in our society about, I think currently about 12% of the population. 5.7% are Hispanic, people on death row. 1.2% are Native American. And 0.3% are Asian American. Less than 1%, one-third of 1%. Now, what that tells us is whites are underrepresented in the death row population because whites, if you count these other four groups as non-white, whites would amount to, I think, still close to 80% of the U.S. population. And yet whites have only 51% of the people on death row. What percentage of the crimes that are capital, that is, can be punished potentially by death, do whites commit? That I do not know. My hunch is, and I have read something on it, but I don't have the figures with me, that blacks, 12% of the population, 42% of the residents of death row, commit somewhere between those two figures in the percentage of crimes, of violence, capital crimes, somewhere between 12 and 42. Less than 42, more than 12. Hispanics, who knows what the Hispanic percentage in the U.S. population is currently? I don't. It's less than black percentage, but I have a sense that it's more than 5.7% too.
8%.
8%, Jody? Okay. So Hispanics, again, as with whites, are underrepresented in the proportions.
But in California, we have a larger percentage of Hispanics.
Yeah, but these are nationwide figures.
So it's sort of not very good representing every state as
Well, not every state is not the same. That's, I think, one of the obvious things. Well, all I'm lumping together now is the racial proportions on death row nationwide. I mean, there's certainly a higher percentage of crime committed by Hispanics in Florida, in South Florida, than in Minnesota, because there's a much higher proportion of Hispanics in Florida. Some do and some don't. Yeah, but I don't think North Carolina and Georgia and Alabama have a high percentage of Hispanics. Texas does.
No, but I was just saying, does Florida and California have the largest amount of death?
Yeah, but I don't know the breakdown rate racially in those states. That data would be available. I just don't have it. But I think the point is that nationwide, Hispanics seem to be on death row in lower proportions than their numbers in the population would predict if you were strictly going by population. Whites are underrepresented on death row. Asians are underrepresented on death row. We have more than 0.3% of our population of Asian background. Native Americans are overrepresented, again, because Native Americans, this I do know, are about 0.5% of our nation's population. A little over a million, 1.3 million, something like that, about 0.5%. But they have 1.2% of the death row population. So blacks and Indians are overrepresented statistically on death row. Whites, Hispanics, and Asians are underrepresented. Now, why is that? I think that requires a very detailed analysis, but it certainly has to do with economic class. It may have to do with the tradition of a people and how violence is viewed within that people. It may have something to do with the heritage of slavery for blacks. My guess is, in some way, it does. It may also have to do with the fact that non-whites live disproportionately in states that use the death penalty. In other words, states without the death penalty, like the upper Midwest and New England, tend to be more homogeneous racially. They tend to be more white. They tend to be less varied racially. States that use the death penalty heavily, particularly the Old South, have a large percentage of people who are not white. And I think that's a factor, too, in these statistics. When you take the population statistics nationwide, you're talking about all 50 states. When you take the death penalty statistics, you're talking about only some states that tend to use it heavily or that have it on their books. So there are figures here that are fascinating, I think, intriguing, but what they really mean requires a great deal of detailed study before we jump to conclusions. Do black people commit violent crimes in higher proportion than white people? I think it's undeniable that they do. Do black people get sent to the electric chair in higher proportion, even among those who are convicted? I think that's also true. And why that is has to do, I think, with economic class as much as any other factor. Yeah? I think the figures for death row indicate two broad categories of reasons for people being there. One is domestic violence, violence in the home, killing your spouse. That could be. The other reason is related to chemical dependency, that a lot of crimes are committed in armed robbery because of the need to get money to sustain a drug habit. Not all armed robbery, but a high percentage of armed robbery comes as a result of that. It's a kind of a desperation act. Now, the mass murder kinds of things that somebody mentioned as a new phenomenon, I think it is, and it gets a lot of publicity, but the proportion of people who are on death row because of that kind of crime is relatively small. That's not the major factor. It's domestic violence and armed robbery in order to sustain a drug habit. Yeah?
Can I ask you a question then? If we do not have the death penalty and then the next increase in crime is violent crime, does that mean that there's going to be a decline in life?
Yeah. We all do, the society, the taxpayers. Oh, I see. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Do we have to work hard like this?
Yeah, I think I know what you're saying now. Well, I think that gets to the question of what's wrong with our criminal justice system, which is another big debate. Whether we should provide custodial care for people who are convicted of any kind of crime that is hoped to lead to rehabilitation and reentry into society, or whether we should just lock them up and throw away the key, which some people say, even people opposed to the death penalty, don't take their lives, but don't let them out. No possibility of parole. The fact is that the life term in almost all of our states is written in such a way that there is the possibility of release. In Minnesota, the standard life term means you serve about 17 years. Life sentence for murder in Minnesota, which hasn't had the death penalty for 80 years, means on average 17 years in prison. Again, you have to look at the statistics about that. Some do get out and commit a violent crime again, but many others do not and live rather exemplary lives. So I think it gets back to the argument again about whether a given criminal's life is redeemable in this world, in this human terms. And people will debate that based on their own experience with it. The unfortunate thing is that the publicized released behavior is the one that turns again to violence. And the people who make it and become part of a functioning society again, that doesn't get publicity. But of course, there are mistakes made. There are people released who should not have been. And the same is true with mental patients who seem to be healthy and well, they're released and they turn out not to have been well. So it's a complicated area, and I think the bottom line is human beings are always going to make mistakes in this area because we are not perfect. And there's no perfect system that's been developed with or without the death penalty. There were other hands up. Yes. You're from Canada.
And in two or three minutes, a little sidelight to this. You spoke of cost. And I was wondering how much effect particular incidents had on the feeling for or against the death penalty. We had a celebrated case several years ago. Probably this turned more people in favor of death penalty than any other single instance in Canada. And many positively were compelled to death penalty. This was the most despicable term.
Yeah, and there's been a move in Canada to revive it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Strong, except the top politicians are opposed to it.
Yeah.
But this man murdered something like 16 children. And very
was he sentenced then?
He was sentenced to life prison. He's considered the most incorrigible, absolutely no remorse.
No.
He's in prison. He's got life in prison. In fact, it seems like a prison. But this particular person is in the circumstance connection. I'm sure it's during many times people.
Yeah. One highly publicized case like that will have a noticeable change in the polls. There are two things I want to say in conclusion. One is that society always has to have some way of dealing with its anger. That anger is real, and I think it's legitimate. And there must be a way of dealing with that anger, And for many people, the way to deal with that kind of anger is the penalty of death. I'm not sure it's the best way, but I understand it, and I'm sympathetic to that need to have a way of dealing with the anger of a society. And particularly when people see that people convicted of heinous crimes who are sentenced to life imprisonment then occasionally are released to do it again. And that, I think we just have to be very sensitive to that. But on the other side, and I feel this very strongly as a believer, I do not think you really break the cycle of violence by doing another act of violence. And I'm one who believes that legal acts of violence are sometimes legitimate. I don't think you kill people. Okay, let me finish. I don't think you kill people who kill people in order to show that killing people is wrong. That, for me, is the bottom line. Now,
Dr. Hines was head of the Department of Institutions in Washington. And he'd been...
State
of Washington. And he'd been in charge of boys' reformatories and of the big penitentiaries and had been a teacher in the university about the problem.
Mm-hmm.
He related this story that in England at one time, where there were a lot of pickpocketing, and one man was convicted of that, and the public was invited to see the hanging.
Yeah.
They
used to have public executions.
Came there.
Right.
And watched that. And then the day after that, there came in 100 reports about people who had had their pockets picked at that.
At the public hanging, yeah. Yeah. That's often quoted as in response to the deterrence argument. If it deters, then how come people at a public execution do crimes that...
Can you make any deterrence at all?
Yeah, that's the question.
Any kind of gathering would no doubt have had the same number.
Right, right. Well, I think our time is up. I thank you. The hour went very fast for me. I hope it was useful for you.